From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journeys Fire. Welcome to the program. Hey, I got some news. After 20 years and 3 months of broadcasting Journeys Fire on this great radio station, WICR, I decided it was time to make a change. I have enjoyed every minute being at this station. When I started, Scott Ecker, the general manager, was an engineer. Shortly, about a year or two into that, he got promoted to general manager, and he's been in that position ever since. And under his leadership, this station has grown. The quality has grown. The students are amazing. I have loved every second of it. But as I've gotten older, I've realized I don't have quite the same energy I did back in April 2nd, 2002. And I want to really get more involved in my public speaking and some voiceover work at a home studio. So this will be my last program. I want to thank all of you who've been listening through the years. It's been a great joy. So the first half of this program, I want to share something that I've been passionate about, mostly from my hospice experience. It's a talk that I give all around the Midwest called Why Awareness of Death is a Secret of Life. And then for the last half, I chose an interview. One of close to 650 that I taped in the 20 years. Which one did I choose? Well, I'll tell you that in about a half hour. But let's go ahead and start with the topic. You know, death has taught me so much about living that I just wanted to share some insights that I've had and also an experience I had that really changed my life. First of all, there's a little story about Abraham Maslow. Shortly after the famous psychologist suffered a near-fatal heart attack, he wrote in a letter, "The confrontation with death and the reprieve from it makes everything look so precious, so sacred, so beautiful, that I feel more strongly than ever the impulse to love it, to embrace it, and to let myself be overwhelmed by it. My river has never looked so beautiful. Death and its ever-present possibility makes love, passionate love, more possible." And then the great astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson said, "It is the knowledge that I'm going to die that creates the focus that I bring to being alive, the urgency of accomplishment, the need to express love now, not later." And one of my favorite quotes was found in The Untethered Soul, a best-selling book. The author was Michael A. Singer. And in that book, he writes this, "It is truly a great cosmic paradox that one of the best teachers in all of life turns out to be death. No person or situation could ever teach you as much as death has to teach you. Learn to live as though you are facing death at all times, and you'll become bolder and more open. If you live life fully, you won't have any last wishes." So I've come to this understanding. Love calls you to make death your constant companion. Because the awareness of death helps you heal old wounds, it refines your life purpose, and you lead a fearless and authentic life. I became most aware of this on June 16th, 2000. I had been working in hospice for about a year or so, and on that day, there was rain all day long. It wasn't a torrential downpour, but it was a nice summer rain. And it was in the morning. I went down early to Franklin, Indiana to see a hospice patient, and I got back on the interstate, and I was driving one of those mini SUVs at the time, and I'm heading up I-65. And then somewhere between I-65 and the Whiteland exit, my car hydroplaned. Now, I don't know if any of you have experienced that, but it'll take your breath away. Your heart starts beating. I started to panic. I lost control of my car, going at about 65, maybe 70 miles an hour. And I didn't know what to do. By instinct, I'm trying to direct the wheel. My hands are gripping on the steering wheel and nothing's happening. And it looks like I'm going to roll over the car. And all of a sudden, it's almost as if I hit an invisible wall. I end up in the middle of the two lanes while my car is moving north, but I'm doing three 360-degree circles. True story. And each time my car faces south, I see a semi-truck and three cars in the other lane coming at me. Of course, all of this is happening in just a millisecond at a time. But I do remember that before that third 360-degree circle, I shut my eyes, I took my hands off the wheel, and I said to myself, either in my thoughts or out loud, this is it. Next thing I know, my car is off on the side of the road, facing north, the engine is off. I am hyperventilating. That's the only time I've ever experienced that. Very hard to get your breath. I'm trying to calm down. All I'm hearing is the rain hitting my metal roof of the car. I heard brake squeals. I heard it must have been the truck just whooshing by, but I heard some of his brakes. Everything was noisy. Everything was a blur there for a while. And then I look in my rearview mirror. Truck's already gone. He's probably hyperventilating while he's still driving. There's about two of the three cars, I believe, in the back. And they're probably feeling the same way, and nobody's moving. And the wipers are going back and forth, back and forth. I'd say in about a minute and a half or so, I started to catch my breath. I pressed the button, rolled the window down, put out my hand, had kind of a little feeble wave as if, yeah, I'm okay. And then I proceeded to drive 40 miles an hour off the side of the road to the Greenwood exit, where I was living at the time. And I didn't live that far off the I-65 Greenwood exit. By the time I got to my place, I broke down and wept. And then I got angry. I got angry at God. I remember thinking, God, how dare you put me face to face with death and you didn't take me? I mean, you mean I'm going to have to probably go through something like this or worse later on? And then I just stopped. And what I was learning already in the hospice work, the death and dying work, I started to say, well, wait a minute. This happened for a reason. What was that reason? Now, the first thing that hit me as I'm standing in my work clothes, nice pants, nice dress shoes, shirt, was the rain outside. It was still raining. It was a beautiful rain. And my first thought was, Richard, when you were a little boy, you used to love to walk in the rain. When did you stop? When was the last time you did that? And I realized it was when I was a little boy. So without thinking, I walked right back out into the Valley Vista area, and I walked for about a half hour in the rain. And at one point during that walk, I had a Shawshank Redemption before Shawshank Redemption movie was ever produced. I remember I had my hands out, I faced up, and I wanted to feel every drop of rain on my skin. And it was glorious. I went back to my place. I was starting to get chilled. The air conditioner was on. And I decided to take a long, hot shower. While I'm taking a shower, my mind is starting to calm down a little bit. My heart is starting to beat at a more regular rate. And I got out, didn't even dry off, didn't even put on any clothes. And I thought, what next? It was the thought, what next? And I thought about a CD a friend had just given me as kind of a gag gift, but it was the Best of Donna Summer. So I put on the Best of Donna Summer, and I just started dancing naked all through my living room with my hands in the air. Nobody else was there. I didn't care. I was beginning to feel life without even being aware of it. And after about a couple of songs, I said, what next? And I looked on my dining room table, and I saw what was left of a gourmet chocolate chip cookie I'd purchased the day before. It was still wrapped up. And I saw a bottle of Merlot wine that I had opened about a week ago, and there was still a little bit left in there. And I decided, man, something sacred happened today. I haven't figured this thing out, but I've got to really sit with this. And my first thought, having been a former pastor, I need to have communion. So I sat down cross-legged on the carpet, and I had communion with my chocolate chip cookie and a glass of Merlot wine. And I just started, for the first time, really enjoying that cookie. I chewed it very slowly. I started to really taste that Merlot wine, taking the moments by moments and cherishing those. And then somewhere along that way, I looked over to the right, and that's where my bookshelf was. And back then, I was pretty much a bookaholic. I had a lot of books, a lot of bookshelves. But I had a spiritual experience. I looked over on that shelf, and there was one book that was almost like illuminated. And it was a book I had purchased a couple weeks ago, but hadn't had the time to really read it yet, but the title intrigued me. So I got over there, I took the book off the shelf, went back to sit down, And I took my thumb, like some people do often with the Bible, I think, just to open it up and see what page you land on. I did that very thing with this book. Now, the book was a new book by Wayne Muller, who has since become one of my favorite authors. The title of the book, How Then Shall We Live? Four Simple Questions That Reveal the Beauty and Meaning of Our Lives. And my thumb took me to page 151. Now, this book was broken down into four chapters, four questions. I happened to turn to the third chapter, and it was entitled, How Shall We Live Knowing That We Will Die? And I thought, okay, God, you got my attention now. And I looked at this page. I instantly had tears as I started to read. And I want to read that page to you right now because it really helped change my life. He writes, with so little time left, there is none to waste. Suddenly, childhood trauma seems less compelling. Money seems useful for daily needs, but greed seems silly. What can we really keep? Unproductive relationships are let go, and intricate career maneuvering seemed wasteful, even comical. For those close to death, it becomes instantly clear that everything they do in their remaining days is precious. Every conversation, every action, every choice is pregnant with meaning and value. Only those relationships that are fruitful and loving are kept. The rest are allowed to fall away. Every act is a sacrament. Every breath a gift. Nothing is taken for granted. Nothing wasted. What kind of life will we have? A human birth is a breathtaking gift. This singular life is a pearl of great price. How will we use this precious time? Sloppily careening from one day to the next, getting things done, checking off lists, buttressing our lives against trouble as best we can until we die weary and wondering whether we were ever awake, ever truly alive at all? Or shall we live not by accident, but on purpose, naming clearly and courageously those things we cherish, creating a life of beauty and love? Will we walk on the earth gently? Will we care for our children with understanding and wisdom? Will we seek out beauty and give thanks for it? Will we be generous with our talents for the good of all? Will we be patient and thoughtful with others? Will we be courageous in speaking what we know to be true? Will we be awake and alive? Will we leave a legacy of kindness? Knowing we will die, how shall we live? Now, every June 16th, since that time, 22 years, I call it Celebrate Life Day. And I try to take some time, either the day off completely or an hour or so in the day, light a candle, and I read that page to myself reverently to remind myself of what's most important. Because, folks, you know this, we live in a crazy, busy world. And it's the dying, I think, that teach us what's most important, because they know they're going to die. And all of a sudden, all the things that they would worry about and fret about, they don't anymore. You know, I have now served hospice for 18 years, and my years of service as a hospice chaplain has reminded me that life and death are part of the same coin. Death is my partner, a constant companion that serves as a wake-up call. Pay attention, it whispers. This is your life. How shall you live it? And so while learning what I've often called the art of living in the light of death, I've come to know that the ultimate expression of love is to simply take someone deeply into your heart and to offer the precious gift of being heard and seen without being judged. Because only love is safe enough to come out to. So who do you know that you could reveal your deepest, darkest, worst side of yourself to, but that friend would still love you would still accept you, would still be present with you. You felt safe enough to share that because they loved you. Because only love is safe enough to come out to. And so I just found that beautiful. Now, someone else who had their own experience was the Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky. You know, every once in a while, something happens that shakes people out of such a mundane existence and introduces them to the ecstasy that lies waiting with hidden potential to be discovered in everyday life. Well, that was such something that changed the life of the 19th century novelist Dostoevsky. He'd never been an ordinary man, but it was the experience of a particular moment that gave him the insight that was so much a part of his genius. As a young idealist, Dostoevsky believed that political revolution was the essential route for the life God willed for him. He joined one of the militant socialist movements that seemed to be omnipresent in 19th century Russia, but his efforts to create the kingdom of God by overthrowing the Tsar came to naught, as his mini-revolution failed, and he was imprisoned by the Tsar, and so he thought, sentenced to death. But he didn't die. Those who challenged the Tsar's totalitarian power were sometimes subjected to a cruel psychological trick designed to break their spirits. You see, they were blindfolded and put before a firing squad, and the commands of ready, aim, fire were given, and the sound of the shots would ring out. But then nothing. The bullets were blank, and the victims had been forced to go through the agony of dying. But then there was not the deliverance that death itself can bring. And the painful process was designed to destroy the emotional life of the Tsar's victims. But in the case of Dostoevsky, it ironically provided a whole new way of living it. Facing death without dying gave him a new perception of reality and ability to apprehend life with an appreciative passion. As the moment which he was sure would be his last approached, he found himself living life with a hitherto unknown heightened awareness. In the face of death, each event that remained in his existence, regardless of how apparently ordinary, took on momentous importance. As he ate his last meal, he concentrated on the taste of every bite, savoring every morsel, because he believed this would be the last food he would ever eat. And as they marched him into the courtyard where he was to be executed, he took in the sun and breathed the air with an intensive appreciation he'd never known before. You see, to the condemned Dostoevsky, every sensation was enjoyed with a heightened awareness. Each experience was felt with a powerful sensitivity. He studied the face of each and every soldier charged with the grisly task of shooting him, because these, he was convinced, were the last faces he would ever see. You see, Dostoevsky was living in the face of death, and later he would confess that he had lived more in what he had been convinced were the last moments of his life than he had ever lived before. In each moment, in each experience leading up to that mock execution, had been seized with a passion. He had tried to suck out of what remained of life all that it possibly could give. He had learned, in the face of death, to live out the ancient Latin admonition, carpe diem, seize the day. Henri Nouwen, the great teacher, wrote this. He said, when we honestly ask ourselves which person in our lives means the most to us, we often find that it is those who, instead of giving advice, solutions or cures, have chosen rather to share our pain and touch our wounds with a warm and tender hand, the friend who can be silent with us in a moment of despair or confusion, who can stay with us in an hour of grief and bereavement, who can tolerate not knowing, not curing, not healing, and face with us a reality of our powerlessness. That is a friend who cares. And so I thought about some of the people that I had ministered to as a hospice chaplain. And I would post stories occasionally on Facebook about these experiences. Here's one of them. A week ago this morning, upon being notified of the death of a hospice patient, I was asked to share the news to the patient's 89-year-old boyfriend, who lived at the facility. First of all, I think that's pretty cool, 89-year-old boyfriend. Sitting across from him, his hand in mine, the tears were flowing down his face. He wasn't completely surprised by the news, but it still, according to him, hurt his heart. He then looked up at me and shared how his dog had just passed a few weeks earlier, and I looked over and I saw an empty crate that his dog must have stayed in. And he asked if it was okay to cry for his dog as well. And as he held my hand tighter, and now tears were flowing down my face, I responded, "Absolutely, and I'll cry with you." And in that moment, no other words were needed. I've had countless experiences like that, where no words were needed. And I learned in hospice and working with the dying, there's something powerful about just being present. Because people can feel if you love them. You don't even have to say a word. They can tell the difference. Here's another story. I wrote and posted on Facebook earlier today. I had the honor of officiating the funeral of an 89-year-old woman who made her transition on October 27th. For almost a year, I would visit with her, often holding her hand and reading poetry to her. And when I would sing to her, she would laugh and try to sing along with me. My attempts at the Sinatra song, "Fly Me to the Moon," was her favorite. She was unable to speak words, but her smile on her eyes said everything. I believe she's flying now, and perhaps she's dancing with Sinatra. And the following words from John O'Donohue really touched my heart. We should not allow ourselves to settle for being awkward and unsure around a deathbed. There is vital and beautiful work to be done there. When you realize that the dying person needs and depends on your words and presence, it takes the focus off your limitation and frees you to become a creative companion on that new journey. And one of the most beautiful gifts you could ever give is the gift of helping someone to die with dignity, graciousness, and serenity. Beautiful. And then finally, I want to share this story that happened a couple of years ago at a facility in Brownsburg, Indiana. And here's what I wrote on Facebook. A dear friend asked me to provide some inspiration to his healthcare team on a Zoom call last Friday. And one of the things I shared was an experience I had with hospice last year. And I do remember it was a lady who I had been seeing, and she was agnostic, and we would have the most delightful talks because I'm pretty broad-based spiritually. And I knew she was declining a lot more, and I knew her family was visiting a lot more, and I was going a different direction, and I got a call and said, Barbara, we'll call her Barbara. Barbara's active. Can you go to the facility and be there? I said, absolutely. And so the story says, when I arrived to her room, she was close to dying, and her adult daughter and adult son were sitting on either side of her, sharing how much they loved her and that it was okay to go. And with tears flowing, they each took a seat and prayed quietly. Eli leaned in close to Barbara, gently stroking her hair. And then I received a download from God. You know what that's like, when all of a sudden you just get a message of some kind? Well, this was an interesting download because it came from an Old Testament chapter that most pastors don't even preach on. The book is called Zephaniah. And the verse is Zephaniah 3:17. So there she is. Her breathing is slowing down. She's unconscious, but we all know that unconscious people can hear every word. And I'm leaning in next to her ear so she can hear me. And I'm starting to stroke her hair very gently. And Zephaniah 3:17 says this, God is in your midst, and he's singing over you with joy and quieting you with his love. And I just kept slowly and softly repeating that verse as I, with each stroke of her hair, Barbara, God is in your midst, and he's singing over you with joy and quieting you with his love. God is in your midst, and he's singing over you with joy and quieting you with his love. And then I got another download. And this time it was from Bob Marley. And then I said, and every little thing's going to be all right. And so then three different times, I said, God is in your midst, and he's singing over you with joy and quieting you with his love, and every little thing's going to be all right. And I repeated that three times, and I'll never forget this. The third time I repeated that, and my hand went on a downward motion and stroking her hair, she took her last breath. It was so peaceful, one of the most peaceful deaths I've ever experienced in 18 years, that I glanced over at her two kids, and they both quietly nodded with me with their mouths open, amazed with how peaceful that was. And I thought, that's powerful. So I want to tell you, the listener, if you're ever feeling anxiety or doubt or fear, please know that there is one who's holding you close and perhaps rocking you back and forth. Back and forth, as a parent would a child, reminding you, I am in your midst, singing over you with joy, and quieting you with my love, and every little thing is going to be all right. One of my favorite quotes is from Ram Dass, who recently passed maybe a couple of years ago, and he said, we're all just walking each other home. And I love that, because it has nothing to do with politics. Has nothing to do with race, religion, tribe, culture, what country you live in. Ultimately, we're all just walking each other home. And I thought about Anita Morjani, who was a guest on this radio show. And she said something in that show, and it's in her book, Dying to Be Me. And she said this, when I was born into this world, the only things I knew were to love, laugh, and shine my light brightly. Then as I grew, people told me to stop laughing. Take life seriously, they said, if you want to get ahead in this world. So I stopped laughing. People told me, be careful who you love if you don't want your heart broken. So I stopped loving. And then they said, don't shine your light so bright as it draws too much attention into you. So I stopped shining and became small and withered. And then I died, only to learn upon death that all that matters in life is to love, laugh, and shine our light brightly. I love that quote. Now onto the interview. This is probably one of my top two favorite teachers. I've been following him for years. He's been on the radio show several times now. But the first interview I did with him was back in 2007. What you're going to hear is an interview in its entirety. It aired January 4th on this station, 2007. And listen to the words carefully, because what my teacher, Father Richard Rohr, has to share back then has everything to do with what we're going through today. So here's my conversation with Richard Rohr. Spiritual Activism with Franciscan monk Richard Rohr, on this edition of Journey's Fire. From WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan with Journey's Fire. Welcome to the program. I'm Richard Brendan. Father Richard Rohr is a Franciscan of the New Mexico province. He was the founder of the New Jerusalem community in Cincinnati, Ohio in 1971, and the Center for Action and Contemplation in Albuquerque, New Mexico in 1986, where he presently serves as founding director. Father Rohr divides his time between local work and preaching and teaching on all continents. He considers the proclamation of the gospel to be his primary call, and uses many different platforms to communicate that message. Scripture as liberation, the integration of action and contemplation, community building, peace and justice issues, male spirituality, and eco-spirituality would all be themes that he addresses in service of the gospel. He's probably best known for his numerous audio and videotapes, and through the Center's newsletter, Radical Grace. He's a regular contributing editor-writer for Sojourners magazine and recently published a 7-part Lenten series for the National Catholic Reporter. And he speaks to us from his office in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Richard Rohr, welcome to Journey's Fire.
Good to be with you.
We were talking right before we came onto the program that you just came back from a grueling trip over in Australia, I believe.
Right. I was on the road 38 days, gave 88 talks, so I'm sick of my own voice. but I'm glad to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate you spending time with us right now. And I would like for you, because this is the heart and soul of a lot of your work, I'd like for you to talk about the importance of the integration of action and contemplation. You know, there's a lot of buzz these days. And you are really at the forefront of this, of what many are calling spiritual activism or sacred activism. Talk about the importance of that.
Well, you know, we named our center here in New Mexico 20 years ago, the Center for Action and Contemplation, because I almost wanted to put it in the title, even though it's a long, cumbersome title, to keep our nose to the grindstone on the integration of those two issues. Because for me, it's the heart of the matter, that we need engaged people in the great social issues of our world, and yet we need them engaged from a deeper place that is not just a place of ideology or anger or opposition. And we call that the contemplative stance. Mm-hmm. So I think the putting of those together is at the heart of so much of our spiritual work today.
As a matter of fact, I was on your website, and I was sorry I missed this, but you co-sponsored, it sounds like an incredible event back in September that you called Outer Witness, Inner Faith.
Yes, Ann Lamott and Jim Wallace and I, we did it twice this year, mm-hmm. in D.C. in January and then in Pasadena in September. And again, it was trying to address that very same issue.
Mm-hmm. In one of your books, you wrote, religion has tended to create people who think they have God in their pockets, people with quick, easy, glib answers. Would you address that further? Because oftentimes these days, it seems that we're hearing those quick, easy, glib answers.
Aren't we? You know, let me put it this way. Mm-hmm. You know, they say if you want to tell a lie, tell a real big lie, and it works. And that we've been able in the West to take the biblical concept of faith, which clearly means not knowing, living without certitude, clarity, an ability to walk in darkness, an ability to walk at a deeper level of trust, and that we've been able to turn that around and make Christianity into a religion with answers for everything. Mm-hmm. It creates very inflated egos, and it's not serving religion very well at all. So I think we've turned around the basic foundational meaning of faith, which clearly meant not knowing. And now we got people who know everything, who know who's in and who's out, who's up and who's down, who's saved and who's not saved. It doesn't create the appropriate humility before mystery. Mm. And I think a sign of someone who has encountered authentic God experience is that they're always going to be humble. They're not going to be glib and smug.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that seems to be what's often lacking in activism. Even though I might support what they're doing, if you're not careful and you're not dealing with the ego, it will rise up eventually.
That's right. And that's why this is a problem as much on the left as it is on the right.
Mm.
And they both keep attacking the other side, thinking the devil's on the other side always. And neither side tends to see its own demons, its own, absolute certitude about what is good and what is bad.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't serving us well.
Richard, what do you see as a religious leader yourself? What do you see as the top issues that we need to be addressing in this country? For so long, what we call the religious right has kind of dominated the discussion and have centered around, quote, family values, around the abortion issue, around same-sex marriage. But there is so many more issues that need to come to the forefront that have everything to do with values.
Yeah, it's amazing that we've been able to create, like the two you mentioned, the homosexual issue and the abortion issue, we've been able to create two litmus tests that have not been litmus tests for the first 1900 years of Christianity. It's like, where did these come from as the proof texts of whether you're really a Christian or not?
Mm-hmm.
And as a Catholic who tries to honor the whole tradition, I really want to say, where did that come from? You know, it's dealing with cultural issues and purity codes and needs to feel superior and right, much more than any reliance upon the teaching of Jesus, who never talks about either of those issues, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas almost every other story of Jesus is talking about love of the poor and concern for the poor. And so it's really rather amazing that people who consider themselves followers of Jesus have been able to ignore many of the major things that Jesus talked about.
Mm-hmm. Talk more about what I would consider the radical nature of Jesus that we often don't hear about, but I think we are now more these days, but just how yeah. radical he truly was.
That's it. We churchified, if that's a word, we churchified Jesus, and we took him out of his historical Jewish reformist context, and we pretty much made him a white middle-class American, concerned about the same issues that we're obsessed with or preoccupied with. And once you do that, once you pull him out of his Jewish context as a reformer of his own religion and therefore a reformer of all religion,
mm-hmm.
I think you pretty much have domesticated Jesus. And the things that we are concerned about are very different than the much more radical concerns of his, which have to do with justice, with mercy, with good faith, as one line from the Synoptic says.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and also with the poor as well.
Yeah, right on. Well, when I say justice, mm-hmm. that's what I'd mean. Yeah, mm-hmm. concern for the poor.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any issues overriding any others that are taking place in the world today that you deem most important?
You know, this might surprise you, and I don't know if on longer reflection I'd say the same thing, but this is what comes to my mind right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think our biggest problem is superficiality.
Mm.
It's just an amazing preoccupation with silliness, with issues of no account, with you know, the lives of movie stars. And I think this superficiality is leading us to miss the heart of most issues,
mm-hmm.
because we just don't go deep.
Mm-hmm.
We settle for cliches, for one-liners, for very quick explanations for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to kill us across the board, because in every issue there's just no depth. So that's what strikes me. You know, that's what allows us not to see the evil of war, not to see the global warming issue as a moral issue, not to see the oppression of the poor as a moral issue. It's just that we're not bad people, I don't think. We're just not very deep people.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with you, and I think a lot of what we see on the news, especially there's a gluttony of entertainment news, is basically numbing us to sleep.
Sometimes, I mean, it's the second or third thing on, as if the rest of the world doesn't matter. For example, we have a woman here on our staff who's a work intern for a year and was very aware of the recent typhoon in the Philippines, where she lost everything and lost much of her family, and whole cities were wiped off the map. Most of us are totally unaware that that has happened twice now in the last 10 days.
Hmm.
While we're preoccupied with Tom Cruise's wedding. I mean, it really, it's rather sad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and I read somewhere, and it could have been one of your books that I read, but
I hope
two. Not. Well, I'd like to think it had a positive effect on me, Richard. But 2/3 of Jesus' teachings were about forgiveness.
Directly or indirectly. Now, I've been told that by scripture scholars, much more scholarly than I am,
mm-hmm.
that in fact, if you go through it, talking about the mercy of God, the forgiveness of God, and or our need to forgive one another,
mm-hmm.
is directly or indirectly the heart of two-thirds of his teaching. That's amazing.
That is very powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
And it also speaks to me about the priority of contemplation, especially for those who are on the front line of activism.
Well, thank you for understanding that. I really agree, and I think activists have lost a lot of authority because they have been seen as mere leftists and have equated leftist politics with the Christian gospel. They're clearly not the same. And I think the style with which we teach and present ourselves gives away whether we're simply leftists or whether we're really coming from a Jesus position.
What are you seeing out there in terms of the response of people as you teach around the world? Are they receiving this message of nonviolent social change?
Well, I mean, my first word would have to be overwhelmingly yes. But, you know, because of my books and tapes, I tend to gather crowds of people who are already inclined toward change or self-reflection or self-critique. So, you know, I had huge crowds in New Zealand and Australia last month. But I don't want to take too much credit for that in terms of, I don't know that that's a cross-section of the whole society. So I do feel a wonderful response almost everywhere I go. But I still know that we're just a drop in the bucket. But, you know, maybe that's all Jesus ever expected. He called it 11. I call it a critical mass. I think that's probably all we need.
I'm speaking with Father Richard Rohr, author, teacher, and founder of the Center for Action and Contemplation. You're listening to Journeys Fire. We'll be right back after a short break. In case you just joined us, my guest today is Father Richard Rohr, founder of the Center for Action and Contemplation. And Richard, a phrase that I have been using in my work in ministry that's become important to me, and actually it came as I was looking at the issues of global warming and going to peace activist type seminars, and I thought, you know, so much of what's going on today is because we have stopped honoring the sacred in all relationships. Could you address that in your observations and work?
You know, I'm going to use a metaphor that I'm a Franciscan, that the medieval Franciscans used, and it was called the great chain of being. It was actually a word for ecology before we had the word ecology, I think. And they said that there were seven links in the great chain of being, the earth and the minerals within the earth being the first, waters upon the earth being the second, the plants and the trees that grow from the earth being the third, the animals being the fourth, humans simply being the fifth, one link, the sixth being the angels and saints, the heavenly realms, and the seventh link being the divine itself. And what they beautifully said was that if we stopped seeing the divine presence in all seven links, or if we stopped seeing it in just one, the whole thing would fall apart. That it's spirituality is an all-or-nothing proposition. Either you see God in all things, or after a while, you see God in less and less and less, and finally, you can't even see God in yourself. And that's what we're facing in Western secularism, that it's become a desacralized universe. And most people can't even believe in the divine indwelling in human persons, in themselves. Or if they can, it's always got to be in other persons who are just like me.
Exactly.
Which isn't a very broad seeing of God. So that's what we're suffering from. The great chain of being has fallen apart.
Now, how does a guy from Kansas end up in a place like New Mexico and the kind of teaching that you're doing around the world?
Well, you know, I'm 63, so I was raised in the 40s and the 50s in a very conservative, wonderful world, you know, where I never knew of divorce in my whole huge German Catholic family. But in many ways, that conservative, grounded beginning prepared me so much for the great bigger world that I got sent into later, because it didn't scare me, because I had been given a good ground, both by my wonderful family and my very healthy Catholic faith at that point. Mm-hmm. It was a solid, coherent, cosmic egg of meaning, as I like to put it, and it gave me something that I'll be forever grateful for. And here I end up sometimes today being considered a critic of the Catholic Church, and yet I always say the only reason I can criticize it is because it taught me the values by which I criticize it. Mm-hmm. And that's the paradox, I think.
Mm-hmm. Were you always aware of your calling into the priesthood?
You know, I was a naive little boy who loved God and had some deep experiences of God as a small boy. So I always knew I had to do something with that, you know. Mm-hmm. So when a Franciscan came to our parish in 1956, that was it. I said, I'm going to be one of those. Mm. And I've never seriously doubted that call. Even though I've certainly gone through many stages of understanding the meaning of it, mm-hmm. and the why I stay has probably changed every 7 years, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's I've had a wonderful life. I have no room to complain about anything.
Mm-hmm. You do a lot of teaching, a lot of writing in the area of male spirituality, helping men grow spiritually.
Yeah.
What are your observations in that area? Do you find a hunger with men more so today than ever before, or not?
Hmm. What should I say? Hmm. You know, once I can open it up a little bit, if they'll mm-hmm. come to at least one event and you can stir the soul a little bit, usually, again, I get great response. Hmm. But what saddens me, frankly, is just how little spiritual curiosity there is in the vast majority of men, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I think many of them have been so let down by religion, disillusioned by religion, angry at religion, that they don't even expect us to be saying anything real anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think we've lost an awful, awful lot of men
mm-hmm.
who, even if they do come around, very often come for the wrong reasons, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
Not on a real spiritual search for God. So again, I'm speaking out of both sides of my mouth. I'm saying yes, but only once you can sort of stir it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't tend to be there in an awful lot of men naturally.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be swept up in the rewards and punishments of this system that we're a part of.
Mm. I read something out of your book, Everything Belongs, which I believe was written and published in, 1999?
Yeah.
And it was at a chapter called Don't Push the River. And, and what I want to just share with you briefly and have you comment, because it touched my heart so much, because I have a grandson, and when I look into his little eyes and I think about what's going on in the world, but you said, my generation is still reacting too much. Maybe the next generation will learn how to put it together. It certainly seems to be a difficult time to live, especially for younger people. Our major concern as we talk about Reconstruction is our passion for the children. We must believe in such a way that we give hope and meaning to the next generation. And how do we balance that with so many serious issues going on, and yet at the same time, almost reminding our kids, you know, let's not stare at the darkness. It's there, but there's light as well.
Well put. You know, you have to stand on a yes. You can't build your life on a no.
Mm-hmm.
You can't start with criticism and what's wrong with everything. And that's the failure for the younger generation of what we call postmodernism. The world which has largely existed in the West since 1968. It's very hard to start building on what you're against. You have to fall in love with something. You have to live inside of what I called before a cosmic egg of meaning. Mm-hmm. And that is still the function of great religion. When the parents themselves, understandably, are spending their middle years growing up, reacting, angry at this, angry at that, they've got to be careful that they don't communicate that foundational anger or oppositional energy to their children. Mm-hmm. Because it's no way to begin. You cannot start your life with what's wrong. Mm-hmm. And when I was talking before about beginning with a very healthy Catholicism back in the 40s and 50s, I think that's the grace of what I was given. It was, first of all, a wonderful yes to a beautiful world. Once I had ingested the yes, then when the 60s came, mm-hmm. and I had to look at all the no's, all the things that weren't working, all the things that were unjust and racist and sexist, I could handle them. You know, I could mm-hmm. absorb them. I could hold them mm-hmm. because my yes was larger than my no, I can put it that way. Now, that's what kids growing up today largely do not have. Mm. And I think it explains a lot of the attraction to fundamentalist religion. Because even though it's oftentimes very dualistic and very simplistic, it still presents seemingly a fundamental yes. You follow me? Mm-hmm. That it looks like love of Jesus, love of God, and the soul needs that. Mm-hmm. So I began very conservative, and I still suspect it's the best way to begin.
Mm-hmm. You've always been known for your passion for proclaiming the gospel, and gospel of liberation also, and a radical Jesus. Where do you see your calling taking you? Is it evolving in different ways that you hadn't seen a few years ago?
Well, you know, I know I'm really, and this is not false modesty, I'm mm-hmm. jack of all trades and master of none. God made it so easy for me to talk about a number of spiritual subjects that sometimes I ask myself, well, which is the one I'm supposed to teach with whatever years I have left? Mm-hmm. And I really do think it's the contemplative mind. And I don't know how long I have, but even personally, I would love to end my own life being much more a full-time contemplative, just living the truth at a soul level, at a mind level, at a heart level. Mm. I finally feel that'll be the best thing I can do for the world. Mm-hmm. I live in a quasi-hermitage now. That's where I'm talking to you from this moment. Mm-hmm. But I still am out on the road half the time. So I would hope as I get older, mm-hmm. I can increase the time here in the hermitage. And, I mean, few people have had as much of their work put on tape and book as I have. So I figure, you know, I don't need to keep saying it. I've already said it.
Yeah, and it also makes for a lot of accountability, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah, very good.
It seems to me also one of the greatest diseases we have in this country is busyness. And I'm wondering, how do you juggle your life and schedule?
Well, see, that's why my Franciscan superior gave me permission to live here alone. That I said, because when I go over to the center, there's always people who want to see me. There's appointments, there's meetings. I can't come home to community, too. Now, I loved community, and I know how to live community. It was the heart of my life for much of my life. But the last years of my life, I know I've got to have big chunks of solitude and silence mm-hmm. In which to pray, to reflect, to write. And that's the way I balance it now, that when I do shut the door here. You know, I try to really keep quiet.
Mm-hmm. For those who aren't familiar with your work, your website is cacradicalgrace.org, and there's lots of wonderful articles. Also, I believe a publication, Radical Grace.
That's right. Thank
yeah.
you.
And Richard Rohr, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Well, it was easy. You asked good questions. So well, thank you for caring.
You had great answers, and thank you for your work. Blessings to you, sir. You know, another great spiritual teacher once wrote, "Imagine humanity committed to universal love, meditating on peace, studied and practiced in the cultural, educational, artistic, philosophical, and diplomatic arts of waging peace. Imagine a world in which war no longer exists. That world is just around the corner as soon as we turn a corner." In closing, here's a beautiful song by Eva Cassidy called, John Lennon tune actually, Imagine.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will live as one. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger or brotherhood of man.
So instead of saying, that's today's program, I'm going to say, and that's the final program, with some tears in my eye. I want to thank you all for joining me, not only today, but also through the year. A reminder that a lot of the past shows can be found on my website, richardbrendan.com. And so I want to thank Genesis Brown and my good friend Angel Richardson, the production coordinator, for helping to make this show possible. I'm Richard Brendan. You have been listening to Journey's Fire, where we have faithfully been bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.
And the world will live as one. You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope some you'll join us, and the world